Donald Trump's election has shaken the world. But how? What are the specific changes and ramifications that we're going to see worldwide because of this? Last week, we looked at heads exploding all across Europe. Today, let's look at how a Trump presidency will affect the Middle East and Asia on Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. My name is Richard Palmer, Assistant Managing Editor for thetrumpet.com. I'm joined now by my colleague, Jeremiah Jacques, who predominantly focuses on covering our Asia region. Jeremiah, thank you for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we spent the first part of the morning with our special live show last week with Joshua Michels unpacking how the Donald Trump presidency is going to impact Europe. And I think already, while the votes were being tallied, you could see the freak out from different European leaders. And we've seen even more of that. It was only hours after that that Germany's government ended up collapsing. And they really are in a tizzy about what to do with Donald Trump's return, what it's going to mean for them. They didn't think it was going to happen, I don't think. Now it has. And they're kind of reevaluating everything very quickly. Jeremiah, what do you think are some of the big changes to pay attention to from Asia?
Yeah, well, definitely some major reverberations. And I'd like to start with Russia, which had hoped for a Trump victory. You know, Trump had said a few different times that he would like to lift the sanctions that have been placed on Russia. Those sanctions were placed on Russia to punish it for its war against Ukraine and to try to prevent the Russians from continuing to finance that war. So if those sanctions are lifted in part or whole, that will obviously be very welcome news for Russia. And then Trump has also said that he aims to end Russia's war within 24 hours of taking office. And what that actually means is really freezing the conflict, not ending it, but just freezing it by saying, you know what, Russia does have legitimate interests here. And whether Ukraine likes it or not, it has to accommodate Russia's interests by handing a lot of its people and territory over to the Russians. So from what we can tell, that is kind of at the foundation of President Trump's plan. And for those reasons, Vladimir Putin and many in Russia are somewhat optimistic about Trump's victory. Putin congratulated Trump after the win, and he called Trump courageous, and he called him a real man. And then Putin's ally, Dmitry Medvedev, issued a statement saying Trump's win will be, quote, useful for Russia. And that's because, you know, Trump's more isolationist, America-focused policies could give Russia a bit of a freer hand. The full sentence here from Medvedev is, quote, Trump has one quality that is useful for us. As a businessman to the core, he hates spending money on idiotic allies and stupid charity projects, end quote. So that's Dmitry Medvedev there, former president of Russia and current ally to Vladimir Putin. And then a Russian politician named Alexander Dugin went one step even further than that. Dugin is a high-ranking member of Putin's party. And after Trump's victory, he wrote, quote, we have won. The world will be never, ever like before. Globalists have lost their final combat, end quote. So we are seeing some triumphalism from Russia, but some of this was tempered. You know, returning to Medvedev's statement from a moment ago, after he said that Trump's victory was useful to Russia, he continued by acknowledging the checks and balances in the United States and acknowledging that Trump's plans may not happen the way he wants them to. Medvedev said, the question is how much Trump will be forced to give to the war. He's stubborn, but the system, the American system, is stronger, end quote. So Medvedev there, you know, he acknowledges that America is not a dictatorship the way Russia is, and that it's tough for a U.S. president, even a strong U.S. president, to always assert his will since, you know, the founding fathers of America designed the system to spread power out. But there have also been reports of Russia celebrating Trump's return because Russia hates NATO. That, of course, is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that binds America and Europe together as military allies. the Russians hate that. And they know that Trump is not a big fan of NATO. He thinks that the US spends more than it should in this framework and that European nations don't spend as much as they should. And so Trump 2.0 is likely to not care as much about pleasing the Europeans. And we even expect some big tariffs on European products. And all of that could weaken NATO. And a weaker NATO is very good news for Russia, because it means Russia is freer to make war on nations that it would like to conquer. So there you go. There is some optimism about Trump's victory from Russia, but it is tempered. The Russians are not exactly breaking out the champagne. And actually, if you look at the man that Trump has tagged as his national security advisor, Congressman Mike Waltz, it looks like the situation could actually be worse for Russia than any of us thought. Waltz is a veteran, and he has said that he advocates for even heavier sanctions on Russia. And he's also mentioned giving Ukraine permission to strike deeper inside of Russia using American weaponry in order to end the war. Now, more recently, it seems that he's maybe backed off on some of that a little bit. But in either case, by appointing Mike Waltz, we may be seeing that Trump's talk about forcing Ukraine to give up land and people to Russia, maybe some of that was a little bit of, you know, just campaign talk designed to differentiate him from Harris and Biden on this issue. So that appointment, I think, could indicate a stronger anti-Russian stance under Trump than we expected. And then you also have to mention, you also have to remember that statements like the ones that I read from Putin, from Medvedev, from Alexander Dugin, these kinds of things cannot be taken at face value. In many cases, the Russians, they just want to divide Americans. So they say whatever they think will accomplish that. They know how they are perceived by most Americans, and they often use reverse psychology, double reverse psychology, triple reverse. There are all kinds of layers and subterfuge with the enigmatic Russians. So you always have to keep that in mind. And then the last thing that I wanted to say on Russia's view of Trump's return is that the Russians remember very well that Trump was the one who blocked the Nord Stream 2 pipeline back during his first term. That was a notable step designed to reduce Russia's power over Europe. So Putin and the other Russians know that Trump is not a pushover for Russia. And the Russians know that Trump does sometimes wield his power very decisively. So on the whole, they will be grateful, of course, if Trump forces Ukraine to give up some of its people and some of its land for a negotiated peace. But there are a lot of big questions about whether that will actually happen. And even if it does happen from that point, I think we should expect Russia to walk a little bit softer for the next few years while it rebuilds its power and kind of bides the time.
Yeah, I do think it's not an easy... You know, some people, I think, seem to view the situation in Ukraine as kind of a slam dunk. Okay, we know that what Donald Trump is going to do. I think your point about, you know, Russia knows the narratives. They know that Donald Trump is accused of being a Russian stooge, and they quite enjoy making play with that. And so if they can make comments that, yeah, they can, and they have played with that. So I don't think we can take those Russian comments at face value. And I think it is just important to remember that it wasn't under Donald Trump that Russia invaded Ukraine. It was under Joe Biden. And I think that's pretty understandable. Like you cross Donald Trump and he could be unpredictable, but I think you could predict that there would be a firm, robust response to anybody that did something against American interests as he perceived them. And so if he perceived that Ukrainian invasion as counter to American interests, he would respond strongly. Whereas under Joe Biden, he said, well, if there's a small invasion, we won't do anything. He really did telegraph weakness on that. So there's the specifics of, okay, what's going to happen? But they've got to be nervous, I think, about that overall approach. Then there's the situation of, well, can Donald Trump end the war in 24 hours? I mean, obviously he can end America's support for Ukraine, but he can't compel Ukraine to sign a peace treaty. And I think that's interesting where you've had a lot of European leaders, particularly Emmanuel Macron, try to put forward a solution whereby Europe takes on a greater burden for the Ukraine war, and pushes that. Normally, I don't think Germany would allow that to happen. With Germany's leadership in complete shambles, maybe Germany won't be able to respond with enough force to put their foot down on that, and perhaps Macron will get his way. So I guess you could see potentially the war continue despite Donald Trump as well.
It's a very good point, yes. And I think we've seen some indications from the Ukrainian leadership that even if the U.S. were to withdraw funding completely and support, that many of them would be inclined to, you know, want to continue to fight as best they could, and they would hope that the European powers would step up and help them. So, yeah, there are more, you know, there are more players here than just the United States, for sure.
And I don't think that Donald Trump would give Russia a treaty that gives them everything that they want. I mean, I think I could see him driving a hard bargain on both sides and potentially forcing Russia, like kind of even going to the Russians and saying, look, Joe Biden has held Ukraine back. Joe Biden has refused to give certain types of weapons to Ukraine. They have told Ukraine, like, don't use these weapons against targets in Russia. We will take all of that off the table. We will take all the restraints off Ukraine. We will end this farce of you can use this weapon here, but not here. We will let them use the weapons we've given them wherever they want, unless you agree to these conditions. And this is what we want from you. And Ukraine, this is what we want from you. Ukraine, if you don't agree to the conditions, we will end funding. Russia, if you don't agree to them, we will give more funding, or we'll remove these restraints on Ukraine. We need you to sit down and stop. Now, you look at Russia's track record in Ukraine and you give him any amount of territory, and Putin is almost certainly going to use that to invade the next bit of territory and to continue to plan war. And in the long run, it's very hard for Ukraine to have an industry that can compete with the Russian industry. So it does seem like anything that leaves Russia in possession of Ukrainian territory is going to be a stepping stone for them conquering more Ukrainian territory if they're not comprehensively defeated. So in the long run, maybe that doesn't matter as much. But perhaps that could settle things for now in Ukraine. But of course, that's not the only, you know, Russia's not the only country you watch. And I think the other, perhaps even bigger focus, at least in the discussions of some of the recent appointments that we've seen for the Trump team, is China. What do you think the Donald Trump presidency means for China, Taiwan, and kind of all the associated countries that are involved in that situation?
Yes, yeah. So of course, that's the other major spot there in the East is, you know, centered in China. And Xi Jinping and the other rulers of the Chinese Communist Party, they have mixed feelings, I think, about Trump 2.0. On one hand, the Chinese economy is woefully underperforming right now, struggling in so many sectors, especially real estate and manufacturing. Right now, China's debt is worse even than America's. Youth unemployment is through the roof, approaching 20% now. So the overall economy is struggling. And some of this is because Biden never ended the trade war that President Trump started with China during his first term. The Biden administration left the tariffs in place that Trump had put on Chinese goods. And Biden actually added to those in a few significant ways, with new duties on Chinese steel and solar cells and electric vehicles. And then most significantly, the Biden administration implemented what's called the CHIPS Act. That's a series of export controls on semiconductor technology. And all of that was intended to just cripple China's ability to fabricate advanced semiconductors. And then the act also incentivizes making microchips in the United States. And Trump has actually said that he is against the CHIPS Act. He slams it as ineffective and too expensive and something that could be accomplished more intelligently with tariffs instead. So China, I think, would be overjoyed if Trump decides to do away with the CHIPS Act. And that could be a real boon to the Chinese economy in a very vital sector. But then on the other hand, Trump has discussed a major increase in tariffs during his second term, and that would be focused largely on Chinese goods. He's discussing 60% tariffs on Chinese imports, which would be really catastrophic for the Chinese economy. That alone could shave something like 2.5% off of China's projected growth. So that would, of course, be a a blow to the already unstable economy in China. And that could give Trump leverage over China to maybe even get the Chinese to put pressure on Russia to end the war on Ukraine. So that's a possibility. And then speaking of war, it's no secret that China wants to control Taiwan. And China has, of course, threatened to wage war on Taiwan in order to gain that control. And the Chinese view on Trump here is, I think, similar to the way Medvedev described him, as a shrewd businessman who doesn't like giving money to countries who don't deserve it, and to, I think Medvedev said, idiotic allies. And so the Russians and the Ukrainian, or the Russians and the Chinese, are hoping that both Ukraine and Taiwan would fall into that category. And Trump has criticized America's relationship with Taiwan. And he has criticized how much the U.S. pays. And he has said that Taiwan should buy more weapons and pay America more for all of that. So the Chinese may be somewhat optimistic that Trump would maybe be a little bit soft on a Chinese takeover of Taiwan. But I really think that that kind of optimism would be misplaced. Trump recently said that if China made a move on Taiwan, then forget about 60% tariffs. He would levy 150% or even 200% tariffs on Chinese goods. And then Trump also recently said that the Chinese would know better than to ever even try to invade Taiwan on his watch, because they know that he's crazy. And he even threw an expletive into that sentence to reinforce, I guess, just how crazy they No, he is. And then it's also notable that Taiwan is responding to Trump's complaints that they don't buy enough U.S. weaponry. After his victory, Taiwan announced plans to buy a massive package of American weaponry. I think it's 60 of our F-35s that they plan to buy, and 400 Patriot missiles. So it looks like Taiwan is really responding pretty enthusiastically to Trump's pressure here, and that's bad news for China. So yes, it is true that Trump isn't thrilled about the U.S.-Taiwan dynamic, and he thinks Taiwan should spend more on its defense, but I don't think that those misgivings on his part equate to any kind of real neutrality regarding China's designs on Taiwan. But Chinese leader Xi Jinping, he did call President Trump a couple of days ago to congratulate him on the win, and he said that he hopes the U.S. and China will get along and cooperate. Now, it would be nice if he would actually take some steps to foster cooperation, like ending his direct support of Russia's war on Ukraine, or calling off his military and paramilitary from antagonizing the Philippines and Vietnam and Taiwan and Japan and so many other Chinese neighbors. Or maybe Xi Jinping could tell his companies to stop stealing everything they can from American and British and European companies that they work with. But so far, we haven't seen anything like that from Xi Jinping. Instead, he just says, hey, Trump, congratulations, you're back. Let's cooperate. Let's get along. Let's sing kumbaya together while he continues to antagonize and bully the world in every way he can. So just to summarize, I think that China is mostly nervous about a Trump return. And I think that they may be on somewhat better behavior, at least for a little while, with his return, but that doesn't mean that there's any kind of meaningful change in the Chinese heart.
And I think it is interesting that Taiwanese trade, I mean, it shows that some of Trump's policies, they're working remarkably quickly. If they are ordering all of those, I think it was a $15 billion deal if they're placing those kind of military orders, responding within just a week to his election. And it shows, I think, he does know what he's talking about in a lot of these things. He does also have some good advice. And some of these, like China, and then before them, Japan, taking advantage of America economically, these have been very long-standing criticisms from him. I think a few things that stand out to me, I mean, one is, you could see Europe responding in the same way that Taiwan has. And I think that would be, as far as Donald Trump is concerned, responding as designed. Like if you have some massive pay deals, or even just European power spending more on defense so America doesn't have to do it for them. And I think that you look at some of these different advisors. I was looking into the Mike Waltz, this new national security advisor that you mentioned earlier, where he initially was pretty pro America supporting Ukraine. And then I think he's changed his tune in recent years, saying, look, the really big threat is China. And actually, in order to allow America to confront this threat from China to the degree that we need to have a more singular focus there. And we can't be worried about Europe, and we can't support Europe, and we can't support Ukraine in the way that we have been doing. And so we need to cut that back. So I think that would tie in right with Donald Trump's worldview on China. Like, yeah, we need to confront China. And I don't think he's wrong that China is a major threat that America needs to take seriously. I mean, we've had articles in The Trumpet wake up to the threat from China. So this idea that America does need to focus its resources on a real problem, I don't think is necessarily wrong. But then that also ties into Donald Trump's view about, well, we need to force the Europeans to pay more. And well, the result of that could well be this Europe that continues to beef up its military and to become this major military power. And as far as Mr. Trump's concerned, that is what he wants. Understandably so, because America has been footing the bill for Europe's protection. But then you look at what people like Mr. Macron said several years ago, where he said, we need to make Europe an independent military power against Russia, you know, against, I can't remember who else it was China. But then he said, and against the United States if necessary. Like, a militarized Europe is not an automatic American ally in the way that a Europe wholly dependent on America for their security is. You know, Europe is not Taiwan. If Europe responds by going on a massive spending spree, they're not still going to remain dependent on America in the face of a much larger adversary in the way that Taiwan is going to. So you could see this pivot to Asia, this pivot to China, really putting more steroids on Europe, accelerating its growth, Europe looking for a strong leader, Europe beefing up its military. I mean, these are things that we've been prophesying about since long before Donald Trump came into office. And I think what ties into that is this Trump tariff plan that you talked about, because China is definitely who he's got his minds on the most, but also Europe as well, and tariffs on Europe. And again, like, not unreasonably, like, there are reasons to be concerned. This is not some irrational fear. And I think his critics write off his criticisms of European economic policy too quickly and kind of like, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, he does. Europe is more sneaky than China is about the way that it supports its industry. China, you've got a one-party communist state. So if they want to offer companies cheap electricity, or, you know, the government can just do that, and it's very easy for them to subsidize their companies, make it artificially cheaper to make things in China and steal all those jobs from America. Europe is much more opaque about the way that it does that. You know, it doesn't put tariffs on goods coming in, but it imposes all kinds of regulations, and some of it's couched in terms of protecting the environment that add costs for other countries. The euro itself is much weaker than a German Deutschmark would be, which is a much more roundabout way of artificially weakening the German currency in the same way that China artificially in the past weakened its currency. So Europe is doing all of these things as well to take advantage of the United States. So I think it's understandable that Donald Trump is looking at this and saying, well, we need the rest of the world to share more of the burden. What I think, though, is the danger is, I mean, the level of tariffs that he's talking about, 60%, or there was an interview where he was talking about potentially replacing income tax, or at least one of his supporters, replacing income tax with revenue from tariffs, that is ripping up basically the World War II peace treaty. Like, that is ripping up the arrangement that the world came to after World War II, where America guarantees and underwrites the global free trade system, and everyone else is allowed to participate in that. In exchange, they don't build up their own militaries. They don't be their own independent powers. And I do absolutely get the criticisms of that. And I think America has shouldered the vast majority of the burden of that. And it was structured in such a way that other countries did not meet the costs of that in the way that I think it should have. And there probably was a better way to set this up in 1945, 1950, that did see Europe fundamentally pay more of its fair share rather than creating social welfare states on the back of American security. So I think there are definitely valid criticisms, but also you rip up the basic fundamentals of global peace for the last 80 years, and there can be major consequences for that. And certainly if you have a Donald Trump come in and imposing those level of crippling tariffs on Europe and upon China at the same time, you're going to fundamentally change the global order in a way that we haven't seen in about a century or more. Probably, I mean, potentially bigger than the fall of the USSR, kind of a change in the way the world is structured.
That's an excellent point, and I think we should expect major changes on the horizon. And the Bible actually makes clear that the giants of Asia, mainly Russia and China, as well as Europe, will become extremely powerful in the years ahead, and they'll actually be among the most dominant nations on the globe. They will be the most dominant nations on the globe, Russia, China, and the Europeans. It talks about an era called the times of the Gentiles. You can see that in the Gospel of Luke there. And in that era, nations like Russia and China and Germany will be the main global players. And you can see right now that there's some real fatigue among Americans about being kind of the global policeman. As you've said, for the last 75, 80 years, we've been the global policeman, and we've spent a great deal of money in order to kind of maintain this order. And really, both on the left and the right in America, more and more Americans are saying, let's end that. Let the rest of the world take care of themselves. We have enough problems of our own, and we don't have enough money to fix everything. You know, our resources are finite. So let's just back off. So if Trump, in his focus on putting America first, wants to make America less of a kind of global policeman, then that could equate to countries like Russia and China having more of a free hand to take the nations around them. And then we could see more of a move into that times of the Gentiles direction. But whether all of that happens quickly or after several years, one way or the other, we know that the times of the Gentiles are here in many ways already. And we do have an article called World Leaders Who No Longer Have a Human Mind. It's by Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. And it's all about the times of the Gentiles. And it shows that these are extremely catastrophic times for the world. But it also shows that in the developments that we're seeing right now around the world today, there is also great cause for hope and optimism. So I hope that you'll check that article out to better understand these trends.
And we'll leave a link to that in our show notes. And just to add to that, what I think is interesting is you look at some of these other prophecies about the times of the Gentiles, and there are several that talk about these new rising powers coming together in a trade alliance. So Isaiah 23 talks about the Mart of Nations, and it lists several of these major Gentile powers that will fall out later, trading with each other. And you combine that with prophecies like those. I think it's Deuteronomy 28:52 from memory. If I'm wrong, George will put something different on the screen there, but that talks about America being besieged in all of its strategic sea gates. I mean, you put all of these different things together and you see that there is a trade alliance of as the times of the Gentiles rise, these powers come together in a trading relationship and they shut out the United States. And so to see talk of just this kind of crippling tariff regime on the rest of the world, you could see that quite easily building into the kind of rise of the time, even the specific way these Gentile powers come together and have this trade alliance potentially emerging out of that. Now, tariffs of 60% or tariffs at a level where America can cancel its income tax before, like, that is so revolutionary. I have a hard time seeing Donald Trump doing that actually quickly, especially quickly. So maybe that won't happen. I think another part of this that is interesting from Bible prophecy is one of these big alliances that we look at is the Russia-China alliance. And you and I have talked about so much on this show, there are these prophecies of this Prince of Rosh that leads this Russia and China alliance. And those prophecies always put Russia in the lead. And it's the Prince of Rosh, like the Prince of Russia, that leads it, not the Prince of China. And Mr. Fleury's talked before how that's an implication that Russia is the senior partner and then China. And so you do wonder whether with Donald Trump coming back on the scene and standing up more forcefully for American interests and especially trading interests in America being taken advantage of by China, it would be perfectly consistent with Bible prophecy for China to hit a massive setback, something that does put them quite clearly in second place to Russia, where I think right now a lot of analysts would say actually they're the more powerful of the two. So I think something like that would be completely consistent with Bible prophecy. So we're certainly watching, though, the shift to a world where America is no longer the policeman and where you're seeing the rise of these different Gentile powers, and you'll see an alliance led by Russia with Russia and China. You'll see Europe rise as a power in its own sense. So great that they're no longer relying on America to pay for their security, but then very quickly they're going to have different ideas, different interests. They will clash massively with the United States, with Britain, with Israel in the Middle East. These Gentile powers, you know, this rising beast power in Europe, Russia and China, they'll cooperate to a certain extent to take down the United States. That is the broad outline of what we're talking about. And then that article that you mentioned, I think, is a great one to go to, because it does then put this in the biblical context of, well, this is all part of God transforming man's hearts. And at the moment, we've got this evil human nature, and then we have world leaders with the hearts of beasts that conquer and destroy other nations. And we've been plagued with that for 6,000 years. And this is about God bringing about a fundamental change in the hearts of mankind as he intervenes in a new way in world events. And it's all leading up to the return of Jesus Christ. And that's really the good news and the hope behind what we've seen with the return of Donald Trump and the U.S. election. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We'll go now to, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll go to Mihailo Zekic and look at quite a different situation with the return of Donald Trump in the Middle East. A new U.S. president is always massive news for the whole world. But I can't think of a time where we've switched so quickly between two such different leaders as Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Of course, since the last time we switched between those same two leaders. I mean, this is a bigger difference, I think, than between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. There's going to be massive changes all around the world, but the Middle East is probably affected more than any other place. These two leaders have massively different views on Israel, on Iran, on how the US should approach conflicts in general. So to help us look at what this change could mean through the lens of Bible prophecy, I'm joined by Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
So what are some of the big ways you think the region you watch will change?
Well, obviously the big thing that's on everybody's mind is the war going on between Israel and Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran itself, and all the other terror proxies that Iran is sponsoring. This obviously is played into, I guess, the psyche coming into this election quite a bit, with more talk about forever wars, more talk about everything under the Biden administration around the world falling apart, and Trump is coming in to clean it up, as he has said about Ukraine and some of these other tension points around the world. Israel is a bit of a special case, though, compared to some of these other trouble spots. If you go back between 2017 and 2021, Israel had a very, very close relationship with Donald Trump, with, say, the Abraham Accords, him brokering that, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, having a more combative focus towards Iran. And with the same guy coming in now, you can imagine what a lot of Israelis are thinking. Actually, this is how Israel's Channel 14 responded when the news broke of his election win. So as you can see there, granted Channel 14 is a conservative channel, but there's a lot of people in Israel that are excited with the prospect of Trump returning to office. You're seeing people put up billboards in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv saying, "Congratulations, Mr. Trump, make Israel great again." You're seeing a lot of just, you know, talk with it among ordinary people. You could go and look on YouTube and just see news organizations asking random Israelis on the street, and most of them, at least from what I've seen, young, old, immigrant, native born, etc., are, "Yeah, Trump's back! Oh, Trump!" So people are really excited in Israel for what a second Trump term means.
And you're getting the opposite from the terrorists. I mean, it was Hezbollah almost immediately launched a missile attack on Trump Heights, this town in the Golan Heights set up to celebrate Donald Trump, recognizing that as part of Israel. You saw Hamas respond almost immediately. So the other side are also very much aware of the big change that this means.
Indeed. But in regards actually what this means going on the ground, they have very good reason to be afraid. Trump, when he was announcing his win, he obviously, there's a lot of policy, I'm sure, that he hasn't exactly thought through yet. His immediate concern is actually getting into the White House. And there's a lot, I'm sure, that he also isn't telling people. But he did make one, I guess you could say, policy announcement towards the Middle East.
I will end every single international crisis that the current administration has created, including the horrible war with Russia and Ukraine, which would have never happened if I was president, and the war caused by the attack on Israel, which would have never happened if I was president, and the entire world. I tell you this, we want our hostages back, and they better be back before I assume office, or you will be paying a very big price.
That's a pretty bold threat for him to go and tell Hamas, basically, either we get all, at least in this case, all American hostages home, or else Trump is going to personally intervene and fix the problem. Very, very markedly different from what we've been seeing from Joe Biden for the last year and a bit. Almost a complete 180 from the get-go. I can't imagine at least Joe Biden putting this kind of pressure on Hamas, and the fact that all these ceasefire deals have been falling apart is testimony that Hamas doesn't take the current government seriously either. Trump has for most of the campaign made statements that he supports Israel, but he wants Israel to finish the war and finish it quickly, which you could take that as saying that, okay, he wants to disengage. He wants this all to wrap up. He doesn't want this escalation to continue. But it's also a green light for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to basically do whatever he needs to do to get the war done, which, again, for a lot of conservatives in Israel, you can understand why that is good news for their ears.
So we touched on this in the group discussion I had with Andrew Miller and Philip Nice when we were kind of reacting to the election last Wednesday. And you started to get into that there. What do you like the time period before the inauguration? How do you see that playing out? Because there is this, like, okay, Joe Biden, it has been threatening consequences to Israel if they cross certain lines. Those consequences are much less meaningful now that Donald Trump could potentially withdraw them as soon as he gets into, you know, an arms embargo that lasts 2 months is hardly a threat that Israel's going to fear. At the same time, though, you also have this situation where the Democrats have done a lot to punish Israel. And I think the big reason they haven't done more is fear of the voters, that they still get a lot of support from Jewish voters. They've been trying to thread the needle between what we've got liberal Jews in New York that support us. We've also got Hamas sympathizers in Michigan that support us. We want to not offend, try to not offend both of them. So this has seen them still send some weapons to Israel, but hold back heavy weapons, this kind of thing. So the fact that there has been an imminent election has stopped Joe Biden from hurting Israel as much as it seems like the left had wanted to. So these next couple of months, is this good news for Israel because the threat of punishment is off the table? Or is it going to be a really hard few months because there's no longer any democratic restrictions on what the Biden administration can do?
Well, we're getting mixed signals. For Israel's part, there are reports that they're actually asking Russia to come in and step in for ceasefire talks with Hezbollah, which, I mean, Russia and Israel don't necessarily have good terms right now, especially with Israel's support of Ukraine. But at the same time, you go flash forward to...
Or Russia's support of the Houthis.
Yes. You rewind, I guess, to the very end of Barack Obama's term and how Israel was actually making overtures to Putin to veto an anti-Israel resolution Obama was sponsoring. I think that the timing of this is interesting. Maybe they know something we don't going in the works, whether Russia would listen to Israel at this point or not is anyone's guess. And another thing I want to touch on before we move on, you mentioned the Arab voters in Michigan. Those actually mostly are voted for Trump, or at least Trump got a higher share of their vote than Harris did, because they see the Biden administration as unnecessarily prolonging the war, and they obviously want the war ended, even if it's not necessarily with a free Palestine. But going back to what Israel is expecting from this administration, we've seen a lot of, I don't really know how to describe it, very out of character moves from this administration and from another Hamas sponsor, Qatar. Recently, the U.S. put a few several B-52s parked at the at their military base in Qatar to get ready for an Iranian potential Iranian attack on Israel. And also, it's big news that Qatar has recently evicted Hamas from having their offices in Doha. And the straw that broke the camel's back apparently was pressure from the Biden administration. Why they would do this now, and why Qatar, who has been able to survive this far between through Biden, through Trump, while harboring Hamas, while still sending millions and millions of dollars to Hamas and to other terror groups, why they're listening right now, I don't really have a satisfactory answer, and I don't think anybody really does until we get more information. But it's, yeah, we're getting mixed signals. As far as Iran itself is concerned, I'm suspecting they're really, really nervous right now, and they're not going to try anything that gets on Trump's bad side. I mean, on last Friday, we had another person the indictment announced by the Department of Justice of someone on Iran's payroll attempting to kill Trump. That's not going to win any favor points once he actually enters the White House. And the day after he won the election, the Iranian rial fell to its lowest record ever against the dollar. So just the election results itself have caused the Iranian economy to plummet. So obviously Iran's not going to give up on its goals. Iran hasn't had a change of heart, but they know that they're on, especially when you look at Trump's track record of, again, maximum pressure, of all the sanctions, of assassinating Qasem Soleimani. They know that they're going to have to play their cards very, very carefully, at least for the next few months.
So you mentioned, and you mentioned the way that Barack Obama, in this kind of awkward period after the election, but before leaving office, he went in and had America allow a UN vote on the status of settlements to pass. And this was, I think, one of the first times that the UN declared settlements illegal at the Security Council. That was a massive blow to Israel. And again, I don't think it's something Barack Obama would have dared to do ahead of an election. He waited until there was no democratic accountability for that action. You don't necessarily see much of the Biden administration, at least in terms of them tangibly preparing for that kind of thing at the moment.
They could very well
be. Right, it's a possibility.
It's a possibility.
But it hasn't happened yet, or we don't see them in the process of doing that.
We don't see them in the process of doing that. And right now, I think, especially when you look at how Obama's responded to the last few days of how the elections happened, and with even the unverified, of course, allegations that Biden himself may have been trying to sabotage the democratic process to take vengeance on those that kicked him out of the presidential race. I think at the moment, the Democratic Party is too busy cleaning up house and trying to heal internal divisions rather than be concerned with anything going on outside. But with that being said, I mean, hell hath no fury like a Barack Obama scorned, I guess you could say. He's been extremely vindictive towards Israel especially. And I mean, he could very well have the mindset of, if I'm going down, you're coming down with me. I have nothing left to lose at this point. So we'll have to wait and see within the next few weeks.
I think your comments bring it back to what we discussed on Wednesday about really Barack Obama's power is being diminished. And I think we saw that in the elections. And maybe we will not see that kind of vindictiveness against Israel from the United States if that power has really been broken. I think it was our July issue. George can stick it up on the screen, our producer. You could go find that at our website, thetrumpet.com, where Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has an article that talks about the spiritual reality behind Donald Trump's power being diminished and why that has happened. So if you want to know more about that, you can read that for yourself. And we talked much more about that on our kind of immediate aftermath reaction show last week. But I think that's a good point, that power being diminished could then have an impact on the Middle East. So, I mean, you mentioned Iran having to tread very carefully. Do we have, are there areas where they've backpedaled already?
Not really. It's still early days.
Right. We are less than a week out from the election. That is important to point out.
As you mentioned, Hezbollah is still firing their missiles. Hamas is still refusing to accept a ceasefire. And Qatar, for their point, is that was the official reason why they evicted Hamas from Doha. What the Qataris and Iranians are telling each other, we're not really sure. There is one place, though, I do think it's a, I guess you could say, if we're going to compare the Middle East to the United States, it's a battleground state that we're seeing tugs from both directions, and that would be Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are still having public contacts with the Iranians. They're still having meetings with the Iranians through this point. And the Saudi government is still criticizing Israel, even going so far as to call what's happening in Gaza genocide, etc., which is a bit stronger language, especially in such consecutive statements, than we've seen from the Saudis for a while. The Institute for the Study of War, a well-respected think tank, says that these overtures are, quote, in order to placate Iran without promising concrete action against Israel, end quote. And the fact that Israel hasn't really been jabbing the Saudis for that shows that they're either still holding on an olive branch and hoping the Saudis will take it, or they know that this isn't actually what they think. Saudi Arabia and these Gulf states, of course, are a lot closer to Iran than Israel is. They have their own problems with extremism and with fighting Iranian proxies. But Saudi Arabia was arguably one of the strongest allies Trump had. That was the very first trip he made back during his first term outside of the United States. The famous sword dancing video comes to mind. But Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia there, he was one of the first leaders to congratulate Trump for his win. And there are suspicions that there will be an extension of the Abraham Accords in the works between Israel and Saudi Arabia, of course, mediated by Donald Trump. That is obviously being very tight-lipped one way or the other within the Trump campaign. But it is something a lot of people are expecting to happen, especially once the war in Gaza wraps up. So in the short term, that obviously would be a blessing for Israel to have to be linked up with such an economic and military powerhouse like Saudi Arabia. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has spoken quite a bit about how in the long term we can expect these alliances to end up hurting Israel rather than harming them. But at least in the short term, with this new period of stability, with the U.S. president backing Israel, allowing them to do things they weren't able to do for 4 years, creating an environment where Israel is not constantly on the war footing, but rather ascendant, that is going to help out Israel at the very least in the short term.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point to get into because it's kind of a microcosm of all of our analysis about Donald Trump. I think you see that in this one story. Like, there are common sense things that you can do that ultimately get back to cause and effect that Donald Trump very likely will do that will make measurable improvements. And I think that's true whether it comes to the US economy, whether it comes to the education system, whether it comes to peace in the Middle East. Like, that he very likely will come in there, he'll deal with some of the causes of these massive problems, he will make it much easier for Israel to deal with the genocidal lunatics in Tehran, in Hamas, in Hezbollah, and absolutely, yeah, that's going to be a massive benefit for Israel and bring a lot of stability. At the same time, though, he isn't going to get God involved in a substantial, substantive way. And so, yeah, okay, we can get rid of some of the terrible, really dumb things that we're doing right now, and that will really help us. But to kind of really get to the core of these problems and completely solve them, it requires a depth of repentance that's much deeper than that, and a change that is much deeper than stopping some of the most outrageous things, like don't hand billions of dollars to an enemy that wants to kill you. Like, yeah, okay, we can make things better by not doing that, but it's not going to be the be-all and end-all of all solutions to the problems in the Middle East. And in going for some of these human solutions, it can introduce sometimes new problems of its own. And the Abraham Accords, absolutely a part of that, where you could well see Donald Trump is understandably so, very keen on peace in the Middle East. Everybody wants peace. And there's been talk from him, there's been talk even in Israel about getting some of these third-party nations, maybe some of these Abraham Accord nations. You could definitely see Donald Trump, the art of the deal, having a peace treaty in Gaza that builds on his Abraham Accords, uses the United Arab Emirates and others to provide peacekeepers in Gaza so that they can go and patrol the area rather than Israeli soldiers, and they'll take over rulership and governance, so it's not handing the nation back to Hamas or handing the area back to Hamas. And you can see them going for that. But we had this, you mentioned this article from January 2021, Deadly Flaw in Middle East Peace Deals, where Mr. Flurry writes, "We all want peace, but sadly, these recent peace pacts have a deadly flaw." And he's talking about the Abraham Accords. "Biblical prophecy gives us deep insight into these agreements. It actually foretells that moderate Arab nations will unite, somewhat like we are now seeing, but they're prophesied not to cooperate with the United States or Israel." You could see that deadly flaw, that deadly trap, become even deadlier if the Abraham Accords are then invited into Gaza. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Flurry's conclusion in that article, he has a concluding section, "The Faith of Abraham." And he said, "The question is, are these world leaders seeking peace God's way? Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu are talking all about Abraham, but they're not talking about what Abraham did and how he lived. Abraham was so faithful and obedient, he was willing to sacrifice his and his wife's only son, Isaac, because God demanded it. Abraham placed his entire trust and confidence in God. For this, he is described as the father of the faithful. To have true peace, we need the faith of Abraham." That is kind of what's missing from the equation. And it's about putting, it requires getting back to faith in God, not faith in man and these negotiated peace deals. And you've seen Netanyahu already say, well, we're going to see the Abraham Accords expand as Donald Trump comes back. And so I think, like I said, that in microcosm is so much of what Donald Trump is going to do. Well, he'll stop some of the very obvious things, but what our nations need is faith in God and to look to God for the solutions to our problems. Now, I think Donald Trump's return allows for a message to go out that wouldn't otherwise be able to go out about that, and that Barack Obama and Joe Biden was clamping down. And you hear we're very, very grateful for that. But the solution to our problems is ultimately more than Donald Trump. And the solution to the Middle East is ultimately more than Donald Trump.
Indeed, I'm glad you tie that in, because that's going to segue nicely with the article I was going to bring up. The prophecy, of course, that we were all alluding to this time is in 2 Kings 14, verses 26 and 28, which we discussed at length when the election was happening with our election coverage there.
We didn't actually get into that too much. Okay. I think we mostly kind of talked about the fulfillments. I don't think we actually brought that up too much. This 2 Kings 14, it's a passage that a lot of people look at as Bible history, the history of Israel. But you know, Kings, Samuel, these books are referred to as the former prophets. They are still prophetic scriptures. And 2 Kings 14, it talks about Jeroboam II. This same character, Jeroboam, he's brought up in the book of Amos, a book by a prophet that is very much prophecy, and much of that prophecy unfulfilled because it's for modern times. So this all tells us there is going to be a modern type of Jeroboam. You know, Amos alone informs us of that. And that tells us, well, we can go back and look at these passages in the former prophets, and that's going to tell us more about this Jeroboam-like figure who anciently led Israel to his largest extent of territory. And we got a few questions after the show, just from some new listeners on some of that background. So I thought I'd take the chance on giving that quick summary. But with that said, do you want to dive back into where you were going?
Yes, of course. Well, we speak often on this program about Jeroboam being sent to rescue America specifically, and this references in that passage about bitter affliction in America and not being any helper for the nation, for Israel. And we tie that in with America, which America Under Attack, Mr. Fleury's book, can go into more detail. We probably go into more of this in other programs too. But what I want to focus on is on verse 28, which specifically says that Jeroboam warred in the context of recovering territory for Judah, or at least being involved in a war that helps the Jews out. And in our print edition for September of 2022, Mr. Fleury wrote an article commentating on this verse, stating, quote, "The indication is that Jeroboam reclaimed something to help Judah, the Jewish nation. This verse ties the politics of the U.S. and Judah together. Further down, he writes, from the time of Joe Biden's inauguration, I predicted that we would have more Palestinian terrorist attacks in Israel because of the change in leadership. That is exactly what began to happen. Anybody should be able to recognize why. And then a little bit later, Mr. Fleury writes in all caps, it appears Mr. Trump may have to recover some of Judah's freedom to even be able to deliver God's message to the cities of Judah, end quote. So again, we are expecting a resurgence in Israel tied in with the resurgence in the United States. And we're expecting it to be tied with what this man, this end time parallel of Jeroboam II, is going to do. And we expect this man to be Donald Trump. And he's not even in the White House yet. And already we're seeing some of these things move forward, as we talked about in the Week in Review last week. But it's not, as you said, not just a picture of roses that everything's just going to get better and better and better until Israel rules the world or whatever. It's so a message can get out to Judah and to the other peoples referred to in the prophecy so they could figure out why all these curses are happening in the first place, so they know why God is letting these circumstances happen and what they could do about it. Obviously, an increased security or better security situation in Israel is going to put a lot of people at ease, but it's also going to be getting people hopefully asking questions as to what now? We just had a really horrible war. What do we do moving forward? And God wants to let those people know what it means to move forward of this, not just physically, but also just renewing their contact with Him.
And in the long run, I mean, yeah, our problems are much bigger. And I think most people understand this. Like our problems are much bigger than something that just a new leader can solve. And yeah, this is what we've been saying even throughout the Joe Biden time in office, that this is about individuals that need to make changes in their lives. Like our social problems, our sins have caused our major national problems, and even things like our national weakness and willing to surrender to terrorists comes from breakdown in society. It comes from child rearing issues, family issues, widespread divorce, women ruling the house. All of that leads to the break of morale, the lack of strength, the lack of ability to stand up for ourselves even on the national scene. A new leader doesn't change that, but what a new leader does is allow this message to go out. And it is all part of God's plan to correct those problems, to correct them at the family level, at the individual level, and to do that in a global way. And once you do that, then you can bring in all of this peace and prosperity beyond what we can imagine. But it takes change on the individual level, not just the political level. And that applies to America in society. That applies to the Middle East as well. So many people have tried to solve these issues of the Middle East. And okay, Donald Trump is not going to bring permanent peace in the Middle East, but he is an important step on the road to that. And Bible prophecy is moving towards that. So there is still a whole lot of good news here. And all of those pieces of material that we've mentioned today, they will give you more information, and you can dig into that good news and that light that's coming for the whole world and for the Middle East. Well, thank you so much for presenting that, Mihailo. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back on Friday with our regular Week in Review show. And until then, keep watching your world.